I was young once. I remember thinking back to my youth at age 19. I found myself in Korea with the Army, South Korea, not the North. And it was a whole different experience for me because, of course, the level of prosperity over there was rather low. I think it's come up considerably since then. That was over 10 years ago. It was over 50 years ago. And so we had some different experiences. Something I wasn't used to that I kind of enjoyed was because of the difference in the economies and the value of American money, I was a PFC. I was able to hire a houseboy, not just for me, but the guys in the barracks. We each would chip in like a dollar a month, which maybe added up to $20 or $30. And we had a guy who would come in and shine our boots and make our beds and clean our barracks and do all those little things that soldiers end up doing so we could concentrate on killing people and breaking things. Well, we didn't necessarily do that. I was in a security detachment, so we were just trying to keep people from stealing. Well, I sort of became friends with this man. His name was Nam Chong Soo, and he was our houseboy. And he was probably a little older than I was. I think he was in his 20s. He was married. He had a child. And he'd come in every day and do his work. And I don't know if any of you have been in the military or been overseas, but it seems like the first people in Korea that we would become acquainted with were gangsters, pimps, and prostitutes who sort of lived in a little village right around the gate to the compound. And I kind of made it my business to get beyond that and to try to meet and befriend some real Korean people. And there were some, and they were fine people. And Nam Chong Soo was one of them. And we'd visit, and he'd tell me about what he had seen during the Korean War when he was just a child and had seen the Chinese push the Americans back across the valley we were in one day. And then he said the next day the Americans came back in and pushed the Chinese out of the valley and up into the mountains. And this went back and forth and back and forth. And so he'd had a lot of experience that I had never had as a youth. And, of course, a lot of things that experiences I never want to have. But so that was interesting, and I got to know some of our other security people. But the American GIs over there were very, well, very bigoted when it came to the Koreans. We had a four-letter word for them, which I won't repeat. And it was not a very good word. It wasn't a very good way of referring to them. But the overall prejudice was that Koreans were thieves, that they would steal you blind. And I was in a security detachment, so it was my job to keep that from happening. But I did realize that it happened occasionally, and I'm sure it wasn't limited to the Koreans or any other racial group. It was, you know, something that happened in that case occasionally, and we happened to be in the position to stop it. But I tried to get beyond that and realize again that the people we were not necessarily seeing because they weren't close to us were just good, decent, normal people, a lot poorer than we are. $30 a month was a pretty good salary over there. And people say, well, everything was cheaper over there. I'm not sure it was. It was just that they got along with much less. Most of them lived in one-room shacks, we would call them, and heated their homes with peat, which is a very soft coal, which they would heat the floor, actually, not the whole room, just the floor, and they'd sleep on the floor. So I, again, befriended this man, and we'd have some conversations, some very informative for me, and we'd joke with each other once in a while, and then one day something happened. We would work all hours, so we would sleep during the day, many of us, and one day I was sleeping, and I woke up, and something was missing. I had a radio. I always had a thing for radio. But I had a radio there that was my companion that I really enjoyed. We'd be up all night, maybe in a guard tower or something, and I'd get to listen to the radio, and it kind of made me feel a little closer to home, depending on the stations I picked up. If they were American Forces stations, yeah, I'd also pick up some Japanese and Korean stations that I didn't understand what in the world they were talking about. But I woke up, and my radio was gone. And one of the guys said, oh, yeah, you know, our houseboy and another houseboy who was reputed to be a thief, I just saw them walking out to the gate on their way home, and they were carrying something about the same size as my radio. Well, all this bigotry that had been fed to me over the weeks up to that point just exploded inside, and I got very angry, and I reported it to the authorities there, the military police who passed it on, I think, to the Korean military police and perhaps the civilian police over there. Now, one of the reasons I was in the military police and the security detachment there was my goal in getting out of the Army was to become a police officer. Never happened, but I wanted to be, based on a situation that happened when I was a teen and my dad was pulled over for speeding. And the New York State trooper who wrote him up a ticket was very nice about it, very courteous. Didn't make my dad very happy because he'd gotten caught, but I thought, wow, if that's what a police officer is supposed to be like, that's what I want to be. In Korea, it's not quite like that. I don't know what it's like now. But back then, police brutality was just a matter of fact. A military policeman who might be a PFC like I was could take a civilian or even an officer at times, stand him in attention and beat them just to get information out of them and try to get a little respect. And the civilian police were the same way. So our houseboy, Nam Chong-soo, and his friend, I'm sure when they got out on the street, in fact, I'd heard that the police then stopped them. Probably they were stood at attention and beaten. Not severely, but beaten enough to be humiliated by it, to be, you know, hurt a little bit by it, to suffer some pain. While that was happening to him, a buddy a couple of bunks down woke up from his day's sleep and said, oh, here's your radio. I just borrowed it. A classic case of bad judgment. I had judged this guy and made a decision to report him, which I don't know that that was necessarily wrong. At least I had that suspicion. But he went through probably some very humiliating experiences. We really weren't that close after that. I think we finally got to be friends again to some degree, but that kind of put a little kink in our friendship. Understandably so. But it was a case of bad judgment on our part, which is what I want to talk about today. And we'll start in Matthew 7 and verse 1. Judgment. Matthew 7 and verse 1. It says, judge not that ye be not judged. And verse 2, for with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged. And with what measure you mete it out, you shall be measured to you again. So many people stop, well, at that first verse and say, well, then we should never make judgments concerning other people. Maybe some of you, I judge this as not a very good TV show, but I'd watched it a few times because I enjoy sitcoms, usually because not so much anymore, but I, you know, worked hard, came home, and I wanted to watch something totally mindless. And I found My Name is Earl to be totally mindless. Maybe some of you have seen that. And the good thing about it is however low you feel you are on the socioeconomic ladder, Earl is somewhere beneath you. But he's trying to come back, and he's a guy who found a winning lottery ticket, cashed it in, and all of a sudden goes back and decides, oh, and then gets hit by a car. And so the whole series is him going back and trying to make amends to all the people he's wronged over the years, and he's got the money to do it. One of the characters, though, that was in one or two episodes was his, I don't remember whether it was his mother or mother-in-law, but she was a middle-aged woman, probably from Arkansas, I don't know, but I forgot where in the country. I think this was supposed to be in Kentucky. But she was also getting into a lot of trouble. And every time she would get into trouble, and Earl, having reformed, would come up and bring something to her attention, she would say, no matter what it was, don't judge me, Earl. End of conversation. And some people feel that way. If you're going to be a Christian, you're never going to judge anyone or anything. That's not exactly what it's saying here. What it is saying is that judging others is serious business. It's not to be taken lightly. It's serious business. And if we're going to judge, we may expect to be judged based on our judgment. But we should make judgments occasionally. 1 Corinthians 6, beginning in verse 1. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 1. Since I began by talking about my military career, brief as it was, there was a big picture of Uncle Sam over here, and they took it down before services today. I'll judge that that was okay. I didn't know that Mr. Sandy was going to use a visual aid. And I had one up here, Uncle Sam, but I didn't need it. I don't think I need it, and I'm beyond that now. But 1 Corinthians 6, beginning in verse 1. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 1. Dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unjust and not before the saints? Apparently here, some of the Corinthians were having problems with one another, and they were taking each other to court. They're suing each other. And Paul is saying, look, let's handle this in-house, I guess is what he's saying here in verse 1. Do not you know that the saints shall judge the world? That's what we're learning to do, to actually judge the world. And if the world shall be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? We should be able to make judgments. Don't you know that we shall judge angels? You and I, at some point in the future, are going to be judging angels. How much more things that pertain to this life? So yes, judgment, judging others, judging some circumstances, is a serious thing. But we should learn to do it, and to do it correctly. But what is it that clouds our judgment, that clouds our minds when it comes to making judgments? Well, sometimes it's because we fail to see our own flaws. Hopefully, over the past several weeks, with Passover and the instructions we have to examine ourselves, we have examined ourselves. We've looked at ourselves. We've looked at ourselves, hopefully, honestly and in a balanced way, and have a better idea of who we are and where we're coming from if we're going to judge other people. Turn to Matthew 7. Matthew 7, beginning in verse 3. I don't know how many of you remember Basil Wolverton. He was an elder in the church years ago, and he was a cartoonist and did a lot of the illustrations in some of the Bible reading for children's books, little purple books that we had out years ago. Also, I think one of my favorite works of his was the illustrations in the Spokesman's Club manual. Some of you may still have that. I found one and sort of stuck it away in a file so I can look at it every once in a while. But he drew some rather bizarre pictures of people making various kinds of speeches. My favorite was the attack speech. I always had trouble with that because I have a hard time getting really angry, and where it showed this guy with this horrible look on his face and the veins sticking out on his neck. But I can imagine Basil Wolverton drawing the picture that Christ is drawing here in Matthew 7, beginning in verse 3. Why behold you the mote that is in your brother's eye? Little splinter maybe in somebody's eye. And you behold the mote that's in your brother's eye, but considers not the beam that's in your own eye. Can you imagine that? A big hunk of wood sticking out of your eye, and you're looking at your brother saying, well, you got a little splinter in there. You need to do something about that. And not looking at your own situation and how wanting you are. Or how will you say to your brother, well, let me pull that mote out of your eye, and behold, there's a beam in your own eye. Again, I can picture Mr. Wolverton drawing that picture. You hypocrite, first cast out the beam that is in your own eye, and you shall see clearly to cast out the mote that is in your brother's eye. So we often fail to see our own flaws, don't we? Because, well, we like ourselves quite a bit. I like me, you know, I feed me well, live a good life, but of course I know I'm not perfect, and I know that in some situations there is a beam sticking out of my eye. Not literally, but metaphorically or whatever. So that's what Jesus Christ is talking about here, seeing ourselves before we go around judging other people. One person told me once, I don't know if it was a wise person, it was my aunt. And she had made the comment that sometimes the things we hate the most in other people are those things that we do ourselves. So we need to look at ourselves first before we judge other people, before we make judgments, whether that's out loud or whether that's mainly something we keep to ourselves. You know, like, you're familiar with me in road rage. All right. Not that I've ever done it, but I've thought it a lot. I think I had a good trip down here today. I think Robert Hancock can probably stand up for the fact that I didn't shake my fist at anybody, but he doesn't know what I was thinking. But I didn't have the opportunity. Now, there were pretty decent drivers on the road today, so I didn't have the opportunity to do that. But sometimes our judgments are within ourselves, and we are just, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier in another sermon, but my favorite sitcom is not My Name is Earl, but my all-time favorite sitcom is called Newhart. It's the second Bob Newhart situation comedy where he plays the part of an innkeeper in Vermont. And it reminds me of a little place where my family grew up on a bay in New York State. And there are some characters like that in that little community. Some of them are related to me. But in the Bob Newhart, they've got some interesting characters. Two of them are Michael and Stephanie. Now, if you watch the show, you're keeping up with me on this. But there are a couple of, I guess you would call them yuppies, sort of snobby, one is upper class, the other one wants to be. And they're a man and a woman, and one of their favorite things to do is to go to the mall, look at other people, and make fun of the way they're dressed. Because no one's dressed as good as they are, or as appropriately as they are. So sometimes we tend to do, how did I get off on that? Oh yeah, we tend not to see ourselves, and we tend to like to look down on other people. And hopefully we don't do that. Again, I've said this, that I think if Jesus Christ walked through the mall with me sometimes and saw some of those people that these two people on Newhart would make fun of, he wouldn't see flaws, he'd see potential. And maybe we need to do that too. Every once in a while I'll see somebody who I think is inappropriately dressed. Well, like a guy in the middle of winter one time at the university in Springfield who was wearing a parka with shorts. And it was 10 degrees outside, you know, and I thought, well, I don't know who this guy was. He might have been somebody, maybe he was a furnace repairman who, if my furnace went out that day, I would love to have him come over to my house and fix my furnace or whatever. Maybe he was going to taking pre-med and in a few years would be a very fine doctor or something like that. I don't know who he is. I just know he was, I thought, dressed kind of stupid for that kind of weather. At least he was wearing a parka. But do we see potential in people, or do we look for opportunities to criticize them for whatever we see? Romans 2, beginning in verse 1. Therefore, it's inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are that judges, for wherein you judge another, you condemn yourself. That you do the same thing. Sometimes we do the same things we hate in other people and we judge other people for. But we're sure that the judgment of God is according to truth against them which commit such things. And thinkest thou this, O man, that judges them which do such things and doest the same thing, shall you escape the judgment of God? You know, we make these judgments. We criticize others, perhaps, who make the same judgments. And maybe I'll ruffle a few feathers. I don't know. But I remember however many years ago it was when the Dixie Chicks said something unkind about President George Bush. And people rose up, burned their CDs. I always liked their music, and what they said about President Bush was said in 7 seconds, and a lot of people were saying, well, wait a minute, it's not the man they were criticizing, they were criticizing the office. Some of these people are the same people today who are criticizing our current president, who is in that same office. So I wonder how legitimate that is. Now, yes, there are some things our current president does and believes in that I don't believe in and I don't share with him. The same thing probably with President Bush. There were probably things, a lot of things that he did and a lot of his attitudes that I thought were laudatory. But sometimes we do the same thing and people would say, you know, it's not that they're criticizing the man, they're criticizing the office. Well, today those same people are criticizing the man who holds that office because politically they don't agree with him. So sometimes we look at people And we judge others because, and we do it incorrectly, our judgment is clouded because we don't see ourselves in the picture. We don't see our own flaws. And we only see superficially. That's another thing. We only see the outside. I look around here, you know, I see a bunch of nice people who I enjoy being with. But I don't know what you do when you get home. You know, I don't know when you're going, what you're going to do when you get to work or go back to school or whatever the case may be. I only see superficially, and so do you. Turn to 1 Samuel 16. And we'll begin in verse 6. Well, the story here, Saul had disqualified himself as king, and so Samuel is out looking for a replacement, so to speak, under direction from God, and comes to Jesse's home, and the sons of Jesse, some of whom were fine, strapping young men, I'm sure. Verse 6, and it came to pass when they were come that he looked on Eliab, one of David's brothers, and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. This is the guy. You can tell just by looking at him. Have you ever seen people like that? People who you look at, they just inspire confidence or admiration or whatever. I'm bothered by one. I'm bothered by a lot of things. But one phrase that comes up, if you see an extremely attractive woman, you say she looks like a movie star. Stop and think about that for a minute. Who do movie stars depict? Well, real people who are extremely attractive. No, they don't, but they do. In order to be a movie star, you can't look normal. You can't look like a normal person. I guess if you're a woman, you've got to be extremely attractive. So that's kind of slanted. And sometimes we give in to that. Sometimes we'll see, you know, guys will see an attractive woman and think, wow, that's an attractive woman. She must be wonderful. I fell into that trap once. Fortunately, she was wonderful. And so we've been married for 50 years now. But at first, you know, I wasn't looking at the content of her character. She was pretty. She was blonde. She was had green eyes. And she had that one quality I was looking for in a girlfriend. She would accept me. I was no prize. My buddy told me she looked like Marilyn Monroe. Some of you younger people don't maybe remember who she was, but her friend told my buddy, "Hey, I've got a she's the one who said my now wife looked like Marilyn Monroe." Then my buddy says, "Oh, I got a friend that looks like Elvis," because I'd learned to shade my peach fuzz sideburns to sort of put a little mascara on there so they showed up a little better. But sometimes we see people, and just based on their appearance, we make judgments. And that's what Samuel has done here. And the Lord said to Samuel, look not on his countenance or on his height, probably a tall person. I can criticize tall people. I'm short, I'm not real short, but I was too short to become a New York State trooper, so that ended my law enforcement career ambitions. Because of his height, because I have refused him. The Lord doesn't see as man sees, for man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. And again, so often we look at a person's outward appearance. You know, what do they look like? How important is that? There are certain things, yes, you can tell from a person's appearance, whether they're neat, you know, whether they're some people deliberately try to look a little bit weird, but you can tell, and sometimes if you stare at them enough, they'll say, what are you staring at? And usually you're staring at them because, well, that's the way they want to be stared at. That's why they do that, dress like that, conduct themselves like that, whatever. But we only see the outside. We don't see what's inside. We don't see what's driving them. We don't see what their overall ambitions are. And again, when I see somebody with dirty hands, I never stop to think this may be the guy who would know how to fix my car if something went wrong. I remember when I was in high school, I took a retailing class. This is in New York State, so the culture's a little different up there. But I remember our teacher said, don't judge people that come into your store if you're in a retail situation. Some guy might come up there in jeans with horse manure on his boots. It may be because he owns several. Well, in New York State, that would be a pretty good status symbol. So you can't always tell just by looking at a person their value, particularly their value to God. And God sees value in everybody. He's got a plan for everybody. Maybe not carrying out the same way he is with us, but still. Eventually, these people that we might look down on and disgust, eventually God has a plan for them. He sees their potential. Isaiah 55 and verse 8. Isaiah 55 and verse 8. Isaiah 55, 8, God says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, saith the Lord." You know, often we don't think the way God thinks. We're learning to, and hopefully every day and every year we become more like God. Our thinking becomes more like God's, but that's not the natural way that we think. I remember one lady saying to me at one time, and again, I'm judging, I guess. I put a little more meaning into what she said, maybe in the wrong way. She said, and we were discussing theology or something, she said, we worship a reasonable God. The next line that I envisioned, it didn't happen, but I thought, and I know what she's going to say next, then he must think pretty much the way I do. Sometimes we think that way. I mean, if I see it this way, certainly God, being a reasonable God, must see it that way as well. But it isn't. He says, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord." We don't naturally see things the way that God sees them. Again, in looking at other people, sometimes in looking at circumstances, we only see superficially. We only see what's on the outside. We only see sometimes what people want us to see, whether that's accurate or not. John 7 in verse 24. John 7 and verse 24. "Judge not according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment." When we judge basically and you know, thoroughly on appearance, we're not making righteous judgments. Because we do have a lot of people that want to look good and go way out of their way to look good. Sometimes we find out they're just like us and we're pretty disappointed. You know, we've got a presidential election coming up. I guess the two contenders have now been picked or pretty much determined, and they will try to look really good over the next however many months, and their opponents will try to make them look as bad as they can. And sometimes it's just kind of silly, the extent they go to. I know Mitt Romney has taken some heat, because he's rich. I'm not taking sides in this debate, but this one thing got to me, that so many people said, "This guy cannot be president. He's rich. How can we have a president who knows how to handle money?" What's the biggest issue today, according to the pollsters? It's the economy. We have a guy who knows how to make money and knows how to handle money. Now, to me, that's a plus. Again, I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to go out and vote for Mitt Romney. But that was one of the big criticisms. Remember that? That was about a month ago. And, of course, these things come and go, and they're gone. And, of course, his wife was criticized because she'd never worked a day in her life. She's just a housewife. My wife is a housewife. She works harder than I do. Well, not anymore because our kids are grown up. But when our kids were growing up, she worked a lot harder than I did. Even before they were growing up, when they were little kids, she had to change diapers. I think I did once or twice, but that was enough for me. But anyway, various things when we see superficially, people are trying to look good. And particularly political candidates are trying to look good. And they want to look good for us. And movie stars and other things like that. Another thing that clouds our judgment is bigotry. Bigotry. That's what happened to me in Korea. I bought the idea that everybody else seemed to have bought, that these people were just a bunch of thieves, every last one of them. Well, that's not true. Yes, there were thieves. Yes, there are thieves in our culture, in our society, and sometimes there are people we tend to respect. Titus 1 and verse 12. Titus 1 in verse 12. Titus 1:12, one of themselves, even a prophet of their own, said, the Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, and slow bellies. I guess that means they're lazy. And this is something that somebody had said, and they said, this witness is true, not that it's true they're like that. This is true that somebody said that. And sometimes we make those judgments based on race, based on national origin, based on a lot of different things. Years ago, there was a movie out called The Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines. Now, this is back in the 60s. But it was a big international air show or air race, I think. And they had these different nationalities represented in there. And each of them was sort of the typical, stereotypical, whatever they were. The stereotypical Germans. I don't want to pick on Germans too much because those are my people. But stereotypical Germans, very rigid, very unfeeling, very stoical. And then the Japanese, who they came in and stole everybody else's ideas, which I think since then the Japanese have come up in our eyes, and we've realized that there's some smart people over there. But back in the 60s and the 50s after the war, it seemed that the Japanese took a lot of our ideas, we thought, and learned how to produce things cheaper over there and more efficiently. So they were depicted that way, and so on it went down the line. I forgot how some of the other people were depicted, but I do remember the Germans because I took particular offense to that. But not really. But I thought it was kind of funny. But sometimes we do that. We look at people and say, you know, all Irishmen are drunks. You know, maybe there's some Irish Americans here. I don't want to get too nasty, but sometimes we feel that way. You know, people from around the Mediterranean area tend to be highly emotional. Again, that's not absolutely true. There may be some that are like that, and maybe the ones we see, but you can't say that everybody is like that. Back in verse 5, same chapter, for this cause left I thee in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are wanting, ordain elders in every city. This is in this area where these people are like that. I had appointed to you. So God, apparently, through Paul, had seen some value in these people that lived on this island in the Mediterranean and set up churches there. So obviously, this reference in verse 12 is not something that God shared, that they're all like that. They're all liars, evil beasts, and slow bellies. Bigotry sometimes clouds our judgment. And we can see so many examples of that now in our history and current events, how much people hate other people but just because they're, well, one of those people. Galatians 3 and verse 28, Galatians 3:28. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither bond nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Jesus Christ, regardless of our national origin, regardless of our gender, regardless of our wealth. We all have access to Jesus Christ and to his sacrifice. He died for all of us. We're the reason he had to be sacrificed, each individual one of us. And he sees potential in each and every one of us. So there is that equality among all people in the eyes of God. Proverbs 24, verse 23. Proverbs 24, verse 23. These things also belong to the wise, that it is not good to have respect of persons in judgment. You know, to judge certain people, maybe unkindly, or maybe favor people because they're, you know, of a certain racial background or whatever. And Leviticus 19 and verse 33. Leviticus 19 and verse 33. Leviticus 19:33, and if a stranger sojourn with you in your land, you shall not vex him, a foreigner, Well, then people, as they used to say back in New York around the turn of the century, people off the boat. Well, my grandfather was one of those. I don't know which boat, but I'm sure he went through Ellis Island or whatever. He was a foreigner. But the stranger that dwells with you shall be as to you as one born among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So people who are among us, who aren't like us, we should treat them like one of us. Treat them fairly. And not go against them, not be against them just because of their, again, national origin, their race, or whatever. Or their status, we'll get to that in a minute. Or their age. Their age, I know, I don't know who Rayman is. I do have grandchildren who can explain that sort of thing to me. And I like the great in all of the hymnals today, or hymns today, because my wife and I are about to become great grandparents. We thought we were pretty good grandparents, but now we're going to be great grandparents, step grandparents, because our granddaughter is getting married, and the man she's marrying also already has two little kids. So we will become, I guess, their step great grandparents. But again, I think we're pretty good grandparents now. We're not great yet. But age. Sometimes we discriminate people against people because of their age. You know, if you're like me, you look and say, what does he know? He's only 35. He hasn't had that much experience like I've had. Or on the other end, when you're young, you say, that old fogey, he doesn't know what things are like today. You know, some people are probably pointing their fingers at me saying, he doesn't even know who Rayman is. Or whatever. Or what was it came up last week? Somebody was talking about androids. And I said, isn't that the thing you take preparation H for? I mean, what do I know? So I'm learning about that sort of stuff. Again, if it's computer wise, and I'm not very computer wise, I can call my grandchildren. Or they can show me how my smartphone works, that's smarter than I am. So sometimes we discriminate because of age, because the person is, well, too young to know what life is all about, hasn't had the experience I've had. Maybe there's some legitimacy to that. Or he's an old fogey. He doesn't know what's going on today. Well, maybe there's some legitimacy in that, too. Another thing is social status. Sometimes social status will cloud our judgment. Right here where we are, I think the next chapter back, same chapter, back a little bit in Leviticus 19, verse 15, you shall do no unrighteousness in judgment. You shall not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty. Sometimes we do that. You know, why is this guy poor? Well, he brought it on himself. You know, he just never did have any ambition, or he made those bad investments. He was always kind of impulsive. We can always find fault with people. Or honor the person of the mighty. You know, sometimes if somebody's rich, you think they got there honestly. Do you really think so? You got to cheat a little bit to get where they are. You know, we make judgments like that based on a person's wealth. But in righteousness, you shall judge your neighbor. In righteousness, not based on social status necessarily. You know, certain things you can tell. But then again, why do we make those snap judgments about people? Deuteronomy 1 and verse 6. Deuteronomy 1 and verse 6. Deuteronomy 1:6. Well, I don't know if I... Oh, 1:16, all right. Verse 16 of Deuteronomy 1. And I charge the judges at times, saying, hear the cause between your brethren, and judge righteously every man and his brother, between every man and his brother, and the stranger that is with him. Again, the stranger, the person who's not like us. You shall not respect persons in judgment, but you shall hear the small as well as the great. And you shall not be afraid of the face of man, and the judgment of is God's. And the cause, if it's too hard for you, bring it to me and I will hear it. Again, as they had a certain chain of command there, and I command you that at all times, all things, what you should do. So here they were instructed not to make judgments based on superficial things, based on a person's wealth or status in the community. Of course, sometimes that works the other way. If you can get some dirt on somebody that's really important or really attractive or really skilled or talented, wow, you know, now you got something. And sometimes it's the silliest little things. Have you noticed how often the headlines are taken up for days with the fact that, is it Pippa? Pointed a toy gun at some guy that was trying to take her picture. Nobody got hurt, but they got a picture of it. And that picture was on the television for days after that. Maybe I watched too much TV. Big story, plastic gun, you know, because of who did it. You know, unless I walk into a bank with it and somebody believes it's real and I try to rob the bank, it's not a big deal. But that was a big deal. Little kid who, the other one I saw, and it was kind of sad if you saw the video of it, a ball player tossed the ball into the seats, and apparently it fell on the ground. This little kid dove for it, and some other people dove for it, and the other people got it, and the kid cried like crazy, and he was on television, and his face was all distorted, and you felt really sorry for this kid and these mean people next to him who took the ball. Well, so it's on national television. Big deal. Yeah, because you felt so sorry for the kid because he had this contorted face, and he was come to find out later, the people sitting next to him who weren't paying attention to his crying, because they're in a noisy stadium, kind of pleased with themselves that they'd caught the ball, later offered to give it to the kid. Well, that they didn't bring that up for days, after days of watching this little kid scream on television. And his mother refused. Said, well, he's got to learn that you don't always get your way just by crying. And again, later a player came up and threw a ball right to the kid, and he got it, and he was happy. But this little thing made so much of a big deal. And sometimes, again, we can see that working both ways in our judgment. You know, people had judged this couple that was sitting next to this kid, even though they didn't really, as it turns out, didn't realize what was going on. And when they did, they offered to give the ball to the kid. But that wasn't brought up for a couple of days, and they were vilified for a few days. So sometimes that happens both ways. You know, they were nice, clean-cut-looking people, those rascals. James 2 and verse 1. James 2 and verse 1, and of course our point here is that our judgment sometimes is clouded by social status. James 1 and James 2, beginning at verse 1. James 2, 1. My brethren, have not faith the Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with respect of persons. For if there come into your assembly a man with a gold ring, I got one of those, and goodly apparel, and there come in a man that's poor in vile raiment, not dressed so good. Maybe his clothes are a little dirty or disheveled or whatever. And ye have respect of him that wears the gay clothing. Now, that has a whole new meaning today than it did 30, 40 years ago. And say unto him, sit here in a good place. And say to the poor, stand over there, you know, sit under my footstool. Don't be too evident. I remember years ago there were a couple families in church there was one family in particular. If my parents came to visit, oh, I'd love them to meet these people. They were successful, and they were young, and they were attractive, and they had little kids like we did. And then there was another guy who was kind of a little bit weird and not too attractive. And I, you know, well, when they come, I hope he doesn't show up. But as the years went by, that guy, well, he's not in the church anymore either, but those other attractive people were about the first to leave back in the 70s when a lot of stuff happened. And this other couple, or the one man who was the only one in the church, he hung in there for a while. He was like a bad penny. He wouldn't go away. But you can't judge by the way people look, and you can't say, oh, look, would you just, you know, Mr. Martin's let me sit on the front row. Must be my gay apparel. The ring. Oh, that's what it was. All right. I'm honored. Be not partial in yourselves and become judge of evil thoughts. Hearken, my beloved brethren. Hath not God chosen the poor of this world rich in faith? That's what it says in 1 Corinthians 1:26, I believe. And heirs of the kingdom which he has promised to them that love him. But you have despised the poor. And don't rich men oppress you? Some do. And draw you before the judgment seats. So we can't judge a person based on their wealth or their social status or their background, racial and national background, or the things we see on the surface. Proverbs 29 and verse 14. Proverbs 29, beginning in verse 14, and ending in verse 14. The king that faithfully judges the poor, his throne shall be established forever. You know, somebody who has pity on the poor, somebody who's not just in it for the money or whatever, or for status. So we can't judge people by their social status. Well, how does God judge? How does God make judgments? Well, first of all, he makes judgments righteously. Jeremiah 11 and verse 20. Jeremiah 11, 20. Jeremiah 11, 20. But, O Lord of hosts, that judges righteously, that tries the reins of the heart. You know, he tests us. He tries us. He gives us opportunities to fail or opportunities to succeed. Let me see thy vengeance on them, for unto thee have I revealed my cause. But God judges righteously. He tries us. He sees how we react to certain things. He also judges with mercy. Aren't you glad? I'm glad. We just celebrated Passover. Except for the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, we should all be toast. You know, what if God judged just the way we judge sometimes? But he does it with mercy. Isaiah 16 and verse 5. And in mercy shall thy throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth, in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment, and hastening righteousness. But with mercy, God judges us with mercy. And I am glad. I'm glad I don't get what I deserve, or what I have earned. And I think each of you, if you look at yourself honestly, feel the same way. He also judges with the end in mind. I want to turn to a book here that sometimes I find a little bit confusing, but to make one big point on it, and that's the book of Job. And we'll start off in verse 1, then I'll chapter 1, and then I'll paraphrase most of the book and look at the end of the story. Job 1, beginning in verse 6, Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came in among them. And the Lord said to Satan, Where do you come from? And Satan answered to the Lord, said, From going to and fro in the earth, walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, Have you considered my servant Job? Job was a good man, by most standards, that there is none like him on the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that fears God and escheweth evil. I don't even know what escheweth means, but I'd like to hear God talk about me like that. You know, and you would too, probably, like to hear him talk about me like that or talk about you like that. But that's what he said about Job, a great guy. And Satan said, well, yeah, does Job fear you for nothing? Have not you made a hedge about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side? Haven't you blessed the work of his hands and his substance is increased in the land and put forth your hand now? And touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. You think he's really that sincere? And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, all that he has is in your power. turned him over to Satan. And upon him put not forth your hand, you know, himself. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. God says, there's Job, have at him. Does that sound fair? I mean, I don't want to see that happen to me. But that happened to Job. He lost his family. He lost his wealth. He lost his possessions. He lost everything. And why did God do that? Because God judges with the end in mind. Again, I've just paraphrased probably most of the book of Job, but let's go to the end of the story and see how things ended up for Job after all this trouble he went through. In Job 42, beginning in verse 12, after all this happened, the end of the story, so the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning. For he had 14,000 sheep, I don't remember the numbers at the beginning of the story, but more, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 she-asses. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And he called the names of the first Jemima, these are the daughters, and the second Keziah, and the third Keren-Hapuk. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And in all the land there were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job. And their father gave them an inheritance among their brethren. And among the after this, Job lived 140 years and saw his sons and his sons' sons and even unto 4 generations. And so Job died being old and full of days. He lived another 140 years after all this stuff happened to him. Think about that. That's, by our standards today, where we're expected to have a, what is it, 67, or 70, that's 70 years. I guess it's over for me. I'm going to turn 71 next month. So, but that's, that Job lived another 2 lifetimes by our standards today in this great prosperity and with all this wonderful things that God had allowed to happen to him. But God made this judgment with the end in mind. You know, with the end in mind. And the same thing Mr. Armstrong used to say about all the troubles and trials we'll go through, all the horrible things that are going to happen between now and the end of the age, all the things that have happened, horrible things down through history. But he said, I read the end of the book and we win. Well, God wins. And if we're with God, we win. So, God judges with the end in mind. He also judges with insight. With insight. And a lot of experiences we haven't had. God and Jesus Christ had experiences beyond what we've had. And if you turn to Hebrews 4 and verse 14, Hebrews 4, 14, saying that we have a great high priest that has passed into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. For we have not an high priest which can't be touched with the feelings of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like we are. Jesus Christ, been there. I was going to say been there, done that. Well, been there, didn't do that. He was tempted like us, and yet without sin. He didn't sin, but he was tempted. And, you know, we can't say that, well, yeah, Jesus Christ has always been up there at the right hand of God. He doesn't know what it's like to be human. He doesn't know what I put up with. He doesn't know the temptations that I have. Yes, he does. And he conquered them. You know, read Matthew 4. And, of course, through his life, he conquered them. Well, we will judge in God's kingdom. We will be judges. Daniel 7 and verse 22. Daniel 7, 22. Daniel 7, 22. Until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to whom? The saints of the Most High. That's us. And the time came that the saints will possess the kingdom. We are going to possess God's kingdom along with him. We are going to make godly judgments the way he does. You know, and it says in another place, I'm trying to think of where it is, that it is God's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. God's looking forward to that. Luke 22 and verse 29. Luke 22. And verse 29. And I appoint unto you a kingdom, as my Father has appointed unto me, that you may eat and drink at my table in the kingdom, and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Now this was spoken to the disciples, but by extension it applies to us. We're going to be with God. We're going to rule with God. We're going to judge with God. So let's take this very seriously. Again, it's very serious when we make judgments. And sometimes our judgments are clouded, maybe because we don't see our own faults, because we only see the outside of the package. We see superficially. Sometimes we're clouded by bigotry and social status. And God judges righteously. He judges with mercy. He judges with the end in mind. He judges with insight beyond what we have. And in the future, we will be judging along with God as part of His kingdom.